The race is on, and Max Verstappen took the World Championship lead with victory in the Monaco Grand Prix, but he needed some help from Ferrari and Charles Leclerc to do so, with a drive shaft problem preventing them from starting from pole position. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to explain how and why this all happened are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Mark, we've had 2 years away from Monaco. It's absolutely great to have F1 back there, isn't it? It may not have been a blockbusting race, but just seeing these cars wending their way through the impossibly narrow streets is just something else, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always a fantastic spectacle, isn't it? And it's just like a celebration of F1 and a celebration of life as we used to know it, I guess. But and hopefully we'll know it again sometime down the road. But always a fantastic spectacle, not always a great race.
Yeah, that's just the nature of it. But Scott Mitchell, out in Sweden. Obviously, I'm here on the ground in Monaco. You're in your Swedish palace, as I like to consider it. But there are people criticising about how it's processional and boring. And the race, there wasn't a great deal of movement. But I think this race does still have something special, even when it's a relatively boring one, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's enough going on throughout the week. And there's enough that's unique about it when we get into the competitive stuff across Saturday and Sunday that more than merits a place on the calendar. It is in some ways a sort of a relic of a bygone era for F1. But I love it purely because it's probably the only race in Formula One that if you tried to make it happen now, you'd never get anywhere trying to make a Monaco Grand Prix happen now, would you? But so it's just one of those things that if it wasn't there, you wouldn't be able to create it. So it's something that should be protected and celebrated because, yeah, there's always something about the Monaco weekend that becomes special and is special. And we saw that quite a lot. I mean, qualifying was obviously a lot better than the race this weekend, but it's still something that's going to go down as a memorable moment from the 2021 season.
To be honest, the Monaco Grand Prix was always a pretty stupid idea, even when it first was come up with. And Formula One cars... Yeah, you can say the modern cars have outgrown it, but Grand Prix cars were always a little bit too big. But I have to say, it was quite nice being here. This is kind of the most normal Grand Prix I feel we've had, because although the capacity was limited, there were fans, not quite in abundance, but there were plenty around the place, and it actually started to have the feel of an event, which Grand Prix obviously haven't from an on-the-ground perspective recently. It felt a little bit like a moderately busy Friday, a normal Grand Prix. Let's put it that way on the Sunday. So there we go. Plus, the Monegasque police decided to change all the ways you could drive, so it was impossible to get into the car park, and it created all sorts of comedy on Sunday. So that they're starting.
Oh, so classic Monaco then. So it really is getting back into it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's very fortunate to be here. But let's pile into it. But Scott, this weekend has to go down as a missed opportunity for Leclerc and Ferrari, doesn't it? Took pole position, had the problem with the left side drive shaft that manifested itself on the reconnaissance lap. So any chance of that home race win was lost. So how much sympathy do you have for Leclerc?
Quite a lot. He did a mega lap at the start of qualifying, and he'd done a great job all week to be in that situation, to even be fighting for pole, let alone score pole, having missed all of FP1 at a track where just doing laps and building confidence and a rhythm is so important was a phenomenal recovery. And then... he did that great first lap in Q3, got the provisional pole, which then obviously became the real pole when he shunted and caused the red flag and stopped anyone else improving. Obviously, he's ended up paying the penalty for that crash, it looks like he has, because it would seem logical that the crash has caused that drive shaft problem, even though Ferrari has sort of left the door open for it to be a potential standalone issue on the grounds that obviously it wasn't that side of the car that got hit, and there was no external physical damage when that was obvious. They didn't assess the drive shaft because it wasn't hit. So, until Ferrari turn around and say 100% yes, that was a consequence of the crash, there is still going to be this bit of wiggle room where you say, well, maybe it wasn't Leclerc's fault at all, and he's just desperately unlucky. But at the moment, it's kind of probably, if I it's impossible to put a number on it, but I'll try. Probably 95% sympathy, 5%, well, it is kind of your fault. But yeah, overwhelming feeling of I'm gutted for him. It's amazing he's got this record of still hasn't finished a Monaco Grand Prix, has he? Now he hasn't. It didn't start this one when he should have been on pole. And I think based on Carlos Sainz's pace in second place, there's every chance that Charles was going to win that race. So yeah, I have to feel sorry for him, regardless of whether it's his fault or not. I have to feel sorry for him.
He hasn't even got to the checkered flag in an F2 race. He's done two F2 starts at Monaco as well and didn't get to the checkered flag in either of them. I'm perhaps slightly less generous in that ultimately it does appear that the crash he had, which was his mistake, obviously deliberate. No, that's just a joke there. Very clearly not deliberate, just to be absolutely clear. It's very likely that caused the problem. Gary Anderson had a bit of a look at it, and obviously it's all connected at the back there, isn't it? So he suggested it was a thwack through the diff caused it. But until we know the full answer, there is that window open. But wouldn't it have been amazing to have a Monegasque driver starting from pole, very likely then going on to win the Monaco Grand Prix? Louis Chiron was the last to do that in 1931, had a tribute helmet to Louis Chiron. So that would have been fantastic. But Mark, where did this Ferrari pace come from? Because it was a genuinely quick car pretty much from the off, wasn't it?
It was. And we've been comparing it to the McLaren in the races so far, because that's about where it races. It contends the unofficial title for best of the rest behind Merck and Red Bull. And it's very clearly got a very different performance pattern to the McLaren. It's slow down the straights and it's not as quick through high speed corners, but it is doing similar lap times. And so by inference, its lap time is coming from exceptional performance in the slow corners. And it's very agile in slow corners and has a lot of downforce in slow corners. Now, because we've only been comparing it to the McLaren, we've just taken that as a trait for that part of the grid that's sort of half a second away from the pole sort of thing. But when we go to Monaco and its power difference doesn't matter a damn, and the drag doesn't matter, we've seen just how exceptional it is in those types of corners. It's even better than the Red Bull, it seems. So yeah, this is the first time we've seen that. Lando Norris had been studying the data very, very deeply in the few races we'd had before this one. And, you know, you probably heard, he texted Sainz after Barcelona and said, I think you're going to win Monaco, based on what I've seen. And Sainz, you know, could see where he was coming from, but didn't share that belief until he tried the car on Thursday. And then he absolutely did. He thought, I can put this on pole and I can win this race. He was absolutely sure of it. And so, yes, I think if you were designing a car only for one track, it would be a lot like the Ferrari.
Well, that's why it's such a shame, isn't it, that they've missed out, because there's not really another Monaco on the calendar. Once you might have said that Hungary, the Hungaroring, is Monaco without the walls, as people used to call it. But really, it's not quite the same. So I guess that might be a track they do better at. But this really felt like a great opportunity for them to bank an absolute hatful of points and get their win for the season, which have been absolutely amazing. But yeah, a huge blow for Charles Leclerc. Just think about all the pressure on his shoulders as the home hero. And yeah, just went awry. And that moment, Scott, when you could hear him on the radio sort of going, no, the gearbox. And he realised on that reconnaissance lap, must have been absolutely crushing for him.
I think I was trying to work out, when I thought about it after the race, what would have been crueler. Well, obviously what he went through, which was cruel enough, but was it not better that it happened then? Like, I know it sucks not to be able to take the start and everything, but once you've taken the start and everything's real, and he probably would have led into turn one, given Verstappen said he didn't have that much grip off of starting second and only just kept Bottas behind into the first corner. So Leclerc probably would have led the first part of the race, wouldn't he? And every mile completed, every lap ticked off, the feeling that he's going to win is just going to get closer and closer. And at some point, it would have failed and he would have retired. And it would have just been even harder to stomach, wouldn't it? So I guess the sort of just slightly less cruel way of doing that is the bandage got ripped off really quickly, really early, didn't it?
Yeah, that's a good consolation.
Well, it's not a consolation so much as just like if you're going to have it, just what's the least painful way of having it?
Yeah, that's a fair point. But ultimately, it was interesting because I spoke to him after qualifying, and obviously he lost a little bit of time at the start of the lap, and he's really pushing on. And he said, well, I did that because that's my strength. That's how I get these amazing qualifying performances. And he did say, oh, do I need to change what I'm doing? I don't know. But yeah, it's Monaco, you pay a very, very high price for small errors. But Mark, you wrote quite an interesting piece on the race website, which argued Leclerc probably would have been on pole even if the three aggrieved parties, Max Verstappen, Valtteri Bottas and Carlos Sainz, had completed those final laps, that of course they couldn't because of the red flag. They all had various tales of being on course for top spots. So can you just sift through what we know about where people were in the laps and why you think Leclerc was in a pretty good position anyway?
They'd all completed sector one. They were all running behind Leclerc, obviously. And Sainz, I think, could still have been contesting pole. Well, they could all, in theory, been contesting pole, but I think Sainz, you can make the strongest case for, because he was only hundredths down on Leclerc through sector one, even though he was a big chunk down to his own sector one best on his first Q3 run. I think the Ferrari was absolutely mega through sector two, which, you know, is the big bulk of the lap. It's 47% of the lap on the timing. So that's where it was fantastic all weekend. It had, it had 3.5 tenths on Verstappen through there, but Verstappen's best, he made an error at the chicane. He says it cost him about a tenth. So just give him that. It's still well over 2 tenths faster than the Red Bull through sector two. Verstappen had gone purple in sector one, that's true, but it was by hundredths faster than Leclerc and Sainz. He wasn't, even with the improved track grip, was he going to get 2 tenths more than the Ferrari for the remainder of the lap? Leclerc's lap wasn't shaping up into being better than his first lap. We don't know whether Sainz's was, because we didn't see it far enough into it. But let's suppose Leclerc's lap wasn't going to be better than his first one. Could Verstappen have done a better time in the remainder than Sainz? I'm not sure he could have done if they both got clean laps. Bottas wasn't quite as quick as the Red Bull in either sector one or sector two or sector three. So, yeah, he was within hundredths after sector one, but it's a very short sector. So I don't think Bottas would have been in play at all. But I think it would have been a shootout between Sainz and Verstappen and Leclerc, based on Leclerc's first time. And my hunch is that it would have been a Ferrari. It might have even been a Ferrari frontal locker.
There is no quicker lap than the lap that cannot be completed for external factors. It's there. It's always the way. That's just the nature. You can understand why they're frustrated, but equally, I think it's important to note that Leclerc did get that banker in on the first run, and that's really important. That's actually been really important this season in Q3 sessions, doing it on the first run, so you've got that insurance if the conditions change or if someone crashes. Yeah, that counts for something. Scott, we've mentioned the gearbox problem, but you heard from Mattia Binotto, the Ferrari team principal, after the race. So where do you think it comes down? What have they said about the problem? Was it pure misfortune? Was Ferrari a little bit lax in its checks? What are they saying?
Well, I think that's what they need to understand, and that's what they're going to try to establish in the analysis that follows this event. Because, as I mentioned, I think briefly, they didn't check the drive shaft because it was the left side drive shaft, and the impact wasn't on that side, so it wasn't the area of focus. They replaced all of the parts that were damaged, because that's what the rules are under Parc Fermé. If the parts are damaged, you can change them. So they changed everything that was relevant on the right hand side of the car. But what they want to look at, what they want to look into now, is why didn't they detect that damage? Could they have detected could they have detected a fault in the drive shaft sooner than they did? And then obviously secondary to that is, okay, what actually happened to the drive shaft? What was it, as I think everyone expects, was it just a consequence of the forces put through it as a result of the accident and the hit on the right rear? And what exactly happened to it? But I did get the impression from Binotto that the priority now is basically working out if they could have spotted it sooner, because basically it took them a matter of well, I think it was probably 2 or 3 minutes assessing the car when Leclerc brought it back after that reconnaissance lap to realise that it was a problem that wasn't going to be fixed. Whereas if they'd been able to find it on the Saturday, even if they'd had to wait because of Parc Fermé to change it until Sunday morning, they'd have been able to make the repairs in time. What I don't know is whether or not they could have identified that fault and repaired it without doing an entire gearbox change. I'm not entirely sure sort of how interlinked everything is. I know that in the past, when a drive shaft has been changed, you have to basically break a seal to do that. I don't know if that's linked explicitly to the gearbox itself, so whether that would have necessitated the 5-place penalty for a full new gearbox, for example. I don't know exactly, because those rules are a bit above my pay grade. So maybe you can answer that one, Ed.
Nothing's above your pay grade, Scott. I think it will depend on exactly what you're changing and exactly what the circumstances are from it. So I think it probably would have likely, without knowing the exact detail, I'm only sort of reading between the lines of what they said, I think if they detected it, probably good chance it would have triggered a penalty. But it is an interesting one. Gary Anderson did a piece on the race website, and he said he was a little bit surprised it wasn't detected, because obviously, yes, the impact was on one side of the car and the problem was on the left, but it is all still very much connected, isn't it? So it's a little bit of a surprise they didn't have a bit of a look, but the question is, was it a diagnostic failure or was it just one of those things? And it could be either. Did you have a feeling on that, Mark? I guess it's very tempting to the fact that it went so quickly as soon as there was sort of significant torque being put through it suggests that it was obviously pretty close to the failure already, but there are obviously restrictions in what you can look at.
It's very tempting to assume it was related, isn't it? Circumstantially, I mean, there's a chance it could have been damaged some other way, you know, some earlier curb hopping that he'd done or something like that, but whatever. I mean, it's until we know exactly which part it was, it was some form of linkage between the drive shaft and the internal part of the wheel, until we know which part it was and how that is covered in the Parc Fermé regulations, and whether that would have been replacing would have incurred a penalty, it's difficult to make a judgment on. But we do know that it would have been awfully helpful had Leclerc not had the crash.
Yeah, it is important to note the correlation doesn't equal causation, so that'll be something they'll really need to look into.
The only thing I'd add is that Binotto was very keen to clarify that they didn't take a risk with the gearbox. I think he said before the race, and I think he said after the race a couple of times as well, that he used the word gamble, that there was no gamble. It wasn't a fault in the gearbox itself, and that was what they'd inspected. There was no risk of that failing. So, yeah, I think he was keen to stress that they hadn't taken any unnecessary risk in terms of sending him out, which obviously then just lends itself to the theory that it was just something they either overlooked or had no reason to check or no ability to check, and that is ultimately what caught them out.
Yeah, and ultimately, whatever the cause, there was no Charles Leclerc in the race, so that's why we've been able to kind of take the Leclerc story and the qualifying story and very much set it aside. So we had a 19 driver Grand Prix with Charles Leclerc having to watch from the sidelines. Well, Mark, we're now come to what is traditionally the beginning of our race review podcast, but Monaco being Monaco, relatively straightforward. So was there ever any serious threat to Max Verstappen and Red Bull once Leclerc was out of the way in the race?
Not really. All he had to do was cover off Valtteri from the grippier side. Which he did quite ruthlessly. As you saw, he was angled very aggressively towards Valtteri, even when the cars were stationary. But he absolutely needed to do that, because Valtteri almost made it level with him, just level with the rear wheels almost by the time he got there. So, yeah, once he'd done that, no, there was, I mean, that was it, really. It was then just a case of what pace do you choose to run the race at? You're the leader, you can run at any pace you want because nobody's going to overtake you. And so it then became a bit of a strategy game. Could you keep Valtteri away from the undercut range as the pit stop window approached? And that question answered itself as Valtteri's tyres gave out long before the pit window opened. And then it was, when's the gap going to appear to drop into? That didn't really need to concern Max, because if he didn't have a gap to drop into, neither did anyone else that could threaten him. But, I mean, Valtteri was 5 seconds, 4.5 seconds behind by then anyway. So all he had to do was a routine pit stop and, you know, not get caught out by any safety car. And it was very, very straightforward. And so, yeah, I would say Max rarely drove it more than 80% of his capability the whole race.
Yeah, that's the privilege of pole position at that race. But really important win, though, for Verstappen, isn't it? Because we talked extensively on the podcast about how really small swings have made the difference in the first four races. And there was kind of a danger that Red Bull were missing a few too many chances. So for Red Bull to get that win, Verstappen to do it, particularly after missing out on pole position, that's, I think that was an important moment for them in the championship. And probably lays to bed a few demons for Max Verstappen, doesn't it, Scott? Because we had Verstappen a few years ago, had that FP3 crash that potentially cost him a shot at victory. So, yeah, he's finally got that Monaco win.
Yeah, he made a reference to that in the post-race press conference. I think he was asked about whether sort of confidence here can translate into a good performance in Baku, because this is another street circuit, but Max was basically pointing out that it all comes down to the quality of car you've got, because he's been quick in Monaco before and he hasn't won in Monaco before. But part of that, he admitted, is because he's shunted too much in the past. So I think this was something that meant a lot to him and the team. His race engineer was not emotional, but very proud, made it clear he was very proud of him on the team radio after the race. I think it's just significant for a few reasons for Verstappen. He obviously leads the championship for the first time in his career. But I just think from the point of view of... Monaco is just a different race, isn't it, to put your name on the list of winners of. It's got to be second after your home race, hasn't it? There's probably not another race on the calendar that would mean quite as much besides having a home Grand Prix to win.
In a way, it is his own Grand Prix, isn't it? Because he does live in Monaco along with every other Grand Prix driver ever to have existed, pretty much. But yeah, a big win. And obviously, there's this little side show with all the talk about the flexi wings going on, which happened particularly on Wednesday. On Thursday even, which was the practice day, where we had Toto Wolff and Christian Horner talking about the flexi wings and the protests. Obviously, we've talked about in the previous podcast. So there's all these little subplots going on in this championship fight. But Mark, you mentioned Bottas. Sainz obviously did kind of pick up the challenge, didn't he? He did get moderately close to Verstappen at one stage, not close enough to make it especially interesting. Then he kind of dropped back. That just seemed to be just losing ground again in traffic. But Sainz was never really able to be a serious threat, was he?
No, I mean, he lost all that time behind Bottas in the first stint. And he tried pushing. They said, do you fancy try pushing? And he said, yeah, why not? Let's see. And so he started attacking. But then, as you say, he ran into traffic. He had a lot of blue flags. And so he'd been pushing pretty hard up until then. So that combination of pushing hard and then losing tyre temperature among the traffic, it triggered a lot of graining in the front tyres, and it took a long time for that to clear itself up again. So, yeah, by that time, Max was long gone, and I'm sure he could have responded had he needed to anyway.
Yeah, and Carlos Sainz, it's interesting because he was disappointed after qualifying. He's even a little bit disappointed after the race, wasn't he? Because he said second place perhaps didn't feel as sweet as it perhaps might have done, given that he knew that maybe this was a win-loss. But I think Carlos Sainz is going to have plenty more opportunities to fight for wins and pole positions in the future. But Scott, Lando Norris, another podium for him. second of the season. Struggled a little bit at times in the second stint. Called the car undrivable at one stage. Daniel Ricciardo, by contrast, down in 12th place. So what's Norris doing that Ricciardo isn't, other than lapping quickly?
Oh, well, if I had that information, Ed, I'd be able to sell it to Ricciardo for a princely sum, wouldn't I? I think the simplest way I can put it is that Norris is able to drive automatically in a way that actually brings the best out of the McLaren. I don't know exactly what it is that is unique about the McLaren in the way it needs to be driven, but Ricciardo and his predecessor Sainz have commented that it does have something about it that's a bit different. I'm not going to say to a conventional F1 car, because there is no sort of default F1 car style, I don't think. But basically, Norris seems to be tuned in to what the 2021 McLaren needs, probably because there is fundamentally a carryover characteristic from the last couple of McLarens. And I just get the feeling with everything I'm hearing and seeing that Ricciardo can't quite do that without consciously thinking about it. And there's probably no worse circuit on the calendar, if you're struggling with that, than Monaco, because everything's happening so quickly that you don't really have time to think consciously about stuff. So you are going to be, what's the best way to put it? You're going to be defaulting to what your natural style is. And at the moment, it looks like Norris's natural style is completely at one with the McLaren, and Ricciardo's natural style is incompatible with it, at least on the level he needs it to be, which would explain why a deficit of 2 or 3 tenths to Norris, which is pretty much what it's been at other tracks, suddenly ballooned into 6 or 7 tenths by the end of qualifying, and it was north of a second at certain points during the weekend. So that sort of frustration and confusion briefly got the better of Ricciardo immediately after qualifying. He was obviously particularly bemused and a bit annoyed, to put it politely. And I think that just sort of tipped him over the edge a little bit, because it was the first time the humility and the acceptance that he needs to do a better job was ever briefly clouded by a suggestion. And, well, is it me? Like, I can't possibly be this slow. So maybe there is something in the car that's not quite working the way it's meant to be. But then by the time we'd spoken to him later in Saturday, they'd had the debrief, and he'd almost sort of switched again to a more resigned, frustrated still, but a bit more sort of accepting position of, well, I guess it is me, because I can see some stuff that would make me go faster. I just can't do it naturally behind the wheel. And then obviously by the time the race comes around, he's mired in traffic. I didn't see what happened, but I assume he must have been boxed in or something at the start, because I think he lost a place or two, didn't he? And I guess once you're there, there's not a pace advantage that you can make any kind of progress. So he just spends whatever it was, because his entire race basically stuck behind other cars, not being able to make progress, and in the end lapped by Lando. So just a truly miserable weekend, and one in which Ricciardo, I think, just wants to pretend never happened.
Yeah, he spent a big part of the first chunk of the race stuck behind Kimi Raikkonen, who did get ahead of him. But I think with Ricciardo, he said after the race that he looks at the data and he can see some differences, but he doesn't think he can do that. So it's just about adapting to the car properly. And I think the comments he made after qualifying, I took it more to mean it was just sort of bemusement and frustration that he couldn't quite understand why, if you see what I mean. That rather than, obviously he was questioning whether the chassis had a problem or whatever, but it was less out of kind of anger and more out of just I'm not quite sure where it is. So interesting to see how he gets on. But Lando Norris, just we've said this so many times this season, just driving really well. We weren't expecting McLaren to be a podium threat, but Mark, he reckoned his qualifying lap was one of his best in Formula One, and certainly a very, very good one to put himself fifth. And from there, yeah, got the podium finish again.
Yeah, it's lovely. He's putting it all together this year, isn't he? He's absolutely flawless this year. This is a sort of it, like his Imola qualifying lap that didn't count because of 3 centimeters over the line. He's done that sort of quality of lap again, hasn't he? and he just produces it on demand now, which is he's always capable of these sort of performances in the previous years, but he couldn't just turn up and guarantee to produce them. But this year he absolutely is. He's if you're saying who are the drivers of this year, he's got to be a contender.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. And yeah, any shortcomings he has this year are very, very, very minor ones, just the normal ebb and flow. You can't get everything right all of the time, no matter how good you are. But shall we visit Valtteri Bottas' sympathy corner, Scott? He's got to deserve a little bit of sympathy, given he's retired because his front right wheel was stuck on the car, which is an extraordinary reason to retire from a Grand Prix.
It's still stuck on the car. It's not going to be removed from the car until the car returns to base. What did I say my sympathy was for Leclerc? Was it 95% sympathy, 5%, well, you know, you caused it. 100% sympathy for Bottas. I know he was being a bit Bottas about his race. Other than that, you know, not quite able to do anything about Verstappen fading away. He seemed to be really struggling with the fronts in the first stint. But what... I don't know what this guy's done. At some point, he must have just, without realising it, he must have just walked under a bunch of ladders or seen a bunch of black cats or broken a bunch of mirrors or something. Because if something weird happens, it just almost always seems to happen to him. And there's obviously no suggestion in any way that Mercedes is doing a half-baked job on Bottas's car, certainly not doing anything deliberately to stitch him up. There's nothing like that. But he's just unlucky. And what the problem on that pit stop is just bizarre. We've seen countless examples over the years of cross-threading and human error in terms of fixing the gun on and all sorts of things, but never, I can't think of any example of a wheel couldn't come off. I just can't think of anything. It's like a really, really, really high tech version of lazily using a screwdriver to try and tighten the screw and just completely rounding off the screw. But obviously, in a slightly different sense. But it's that kind of just a bizarre sort of consequence that I think Toto Wolff described it. What was the phrase he used? Just like catastrophic failure, which, yeah, I think that fairly sums it up. It certainly was a utterly bizarre failure.
Yeah, he showed a few of us a picture he had on his phone of the wheel nut, and it was totally stripped. It wasn't completely smooth, but it was as good as. There was nothing to grip onto, which is why they're going to have to they talk about taking a hammer or a saw to it or something to get it off. I think it's going to have to be something even more heavy duty to do it. But yeah, unlucky for Bottas. Ultimately, did outperform Lewis Hamilton, so that's no bad thing. But Mark, what did go so badly wrong for Lewis Hamilton, both in terms of the qualifying performance and also the fact he ended up losing places to Perez and Vettel in the race? They were expecting him to maybe go forward, and he briefly did, but then he ended up back in seventh where he started.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental underlying problem with the car this weekend was that it didn't work its tyres hard enough, which is the reason it won in Barcelona and the reason it was in trouble here. But as you say, Valtteri dealt with that problem rather better than Lewis had. And he was Valtteri when the car has got a fundamental sort of front end lack, which is what it had here. Valtteri tends to just go with it and just drive around it. And if you can do that sufficiently that you just nibble into the tire temperature window, suddenly the tire will switch on and the car will suddenly become respectable. If you're the wrong side of that threshold, it's nowhere. That's just how a tire, racing tire behaves. Lewis, they ended up with the same setup, but Lewis just did not believe in it, was not confident in it. He couldn't get any tire temperature. He couldn't get any tire temperature in the rear. So it was nervous under braking. You saw him have all sorts of moments in FP3. He just couldn't believe in it. And he never had the confidence to go with it. And the key corner was Zandvoort, which is where Valtteri was actually entering pretty much on faith, because the messages the car's sending weren't good, but he was just going through there on faith, and that was just enough to get the tire switched on, reasonable amount. And then he could get the tap with a decent front end, he could then start generating the temperatures in the rear, and the whole thing sort of half made sense. But Lewis never did get it into that window, which is what defined his qualifying position. And then in the race, the Mercedes, on both Mercedes, were just eating the tires, because in order to get that little bit of temperature that they were able to get, it had quite an extreme setup on it, which just ate the tires. And that explains why the direction that Lewis wanted to go, he was overruled on, because they knew that that was just going to be disastrous. And you saw how it was with the setup that they had. It ate the tires. There was no tread left on the tires that came off Valtteri's car on the rears, and there was very little left on Lewis's. So they couldn't have done the overcut strategy that worked for, say, Perez or Vettel. They couldn't have done that. They had no tires left by the time the pit stop window opened. So, yeah, they went for the undercut, and it didn't work. And that made Lewis even more angry. But, yeah, that's just the car wasn't very good, and he didn't get it into the window.
Yeah, and then you ended up with Perez getting ahead up into fourth place, Sebastian Vettel as well into fifth, and Pierre Gasly sixth place. We'll talk a little bit about Vettel in a minute. Pierre Gasly, bit of a surprise for AlphaTauri to be quite so strong around Monaco, wasn't it, Scott?
Yeah, it was. I think the sort of general expectation, even within the team, at least sort of a week or two ago, was that this would be a difficult weekend. They'd discovered early on that they had a bit of a weakness in low-speed corners, and then that had been proven in Portugal, and then again when they struggled again in the final sector of Barcelona. But I guess similar with McLaren, because McLaren went into this weekend sort of expecting to struggle a little bit. Monaco is unique. Even though it is low speed, it's not the same kind of low speed corners as you'd find on a conventional track, and there's other challenges as well, including the compliance of the car over the curb and chiefly sort of the confidence it gives the drivers. So I guess if you've got the confidence to attack, then you're always going to find a little bit more. And actually, McLaren and AlphaTauri were both good examples of that, weren't they? Because they both had one driver who seemed to be absolutely on it in Lando Norris and Pierre Gasly, and one driver who just wasn't quite with it in the same way. And obviously, that was Ricciardo and then Yuki Tsunoda. So, yeah, I think you basically take either AlphaTauri driver as sort of evidence of why they expected to struggle, I suppose, because Gasly sort of slightly exceeded expectations because he did everything right, and Tsunoda was at the other end of the extreme because everything that could have gone wrong for him, I guess, did. And in the end, I think Gasly just sort of showed the caliber of driver he has developed into. He's had a little bit of a hit and miss start to the season, but the peaks have been really high as they were last year. And yeah, this looked like another example of that, because he just seemed to be able to hook everything up. And he must have exceeded his expectations that he had going into this weekend.
Yeah, he was certainly very happy afterwards. Sergio Perez, just a quick word on him. Came through to fourth, qualified ninth, obviously. Q3 was disastrous for him, and traffic, and struggled to get the front tyres up to temperature. But for him, it's just all about not being on top of the car for qualifying. He managed to overcut three cars in the race, which, yes, he had the car pace to do it, but still needed to be done by him. Got a decent result out of it, still waiting for that first Red Bull podium. But, yeah, a little bit more work to do there, but solid point. So that's a positive for him. And, yeah, he's had his five races that he's talked about in terms of getting his eye in. So we look to Baku and now expecting him to find a bit more performance on Saturday. But I think he's slightly surprised by just how hard that qualifying performance is to find in terms of the car. He said it's difficult when there's things you have to adapt to and conditions change and the tyre. When you've been in a team for a long time, you have a bit of an advantage, as Verstappen has. So, yeah, more work to be done there for him. Well, Scott, we had Aston Martin drivers, both in the top 10. Sebastian Vettel in fifth place, and Lance Stroll did the long first stint and came through in eighth place. Had a few moments when he clattered over the swimming pool exit chicane, but double points. Quite a positive day for Aston Martin, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I think they got nearly triple the number of points today as they did in the first four races combined. And it actually elevated the team to fifth in the championship, to be honest. If based on how the first three or four races went, if you offered them fifth in the championship at the end of the year, I think they'd bite your hand off for it, to be honest, because that car's not been particularly competitive. And this was a very good way of Vettel scoring those first points for Aston, because I think Spain was quite encouraging for a couple of reasons, and this was obviously the second time he'd banked a top 10 start. And obviously that being Monaco immediately makes it more likely that you're going to get those first points. But he was then able to actually turn, you know, just a break-free points finish into a really good result, which I think is going to be, I think it's just going to be a bit of a weight off his shoulder. I think it's going to be a shot in the arm for the team, because I think they've been a little bit distracted in the first few races and some of their operations haven't been particularly sharp. But this was the opposite. This was brilliant. This was the team back to its best in terms of maximizing opportunities, and Vettel's ability to tough it out against Gasly when he came out of the pits after that slightly longer first stint was a good example of that. And Stroll's drive, extending that first stint, having the pace to do it, was just the icing on the cake. Because if you, I can't remember off the top of my head, Eddie, you might be able to fill in the mental blank that I've got here, but if you turn whatever it was, would it have been like eighth on the grid and outside the top 10 for Stroll into a double points finish, fifth and eighth? That's a really good job in the midfield. I know that a couple of cars obviously hit problems, but either way, that's a really strong result.
Yeah, they've done well. Yeah, Stroll started down in 13th. Mark, what do you make of Vettel? Because this is a really strong weekend from him, and I think, because Aston Martin has struggled, everyone's just kind of got drawn into just thinking it's all going terribly for Vettel. But he looked really good this weekend, didn't he? And he seems quite happy about life.
Yeah, green shoots of recovery were there in Spain. And he put it all together this weekend. Right from the moment the cars were running on Thursday, he looked strong. He looked quicker than Stroll immediately. And that you saw that pattern just be maintained throughout the weekend. And then he delivered a beautiful result. I mean, that looked like a proper world-class driver in a fairly average car. And it wasn't just the way he toughed it out with Gasly. It was the rapid way he closed down on Hamilton and Gasly before that, and having given himself a big gap to look after the tyres. And then as the pit stop window opened, really started nailing it. And for a while, he was lapping as quick as Verstappen. Not that Verstappen was anywhere near his limit, but he was, you know, among the quickest cars on the track, going way quicker than Hamilton or Gasly were able to go. And he just came out of nowhere for those two. You know, he wasn't even on their radar as a threat around the pit stops, and all of a sudden, there he was, overcutting them both. So, yeah, it was a terrific performance, I thought. And that was the first proper glimpse of the old Vettel we've seen this year, I think.
Yeah, very, very encouraging, just being able to dig in and deliver that pace when he really needs it. Extremely positive. Looking down the bottle for the last few points, very, very congested. Esteban Ocon got ninth ahead of Antonio Giovinazzi. Now, Alpine had pretty high hopes coming into the weekend, but ninth place for Ocon represented actually a pretty good result. So why were things so disappointing?
They were having pretty much the same problems as Mercedes. They just could not get the tyres to work at all. So, yeah, it's obviously not something that they were expecting. They were talking about, you know, continuing to fight with Ferrari, which they'd been doing in Portimao and Barcelona. It did comparable performance to the Ferrari, but clearly just not able to switch the tyres on anything like as well. And, yeah, I think a lot of head scratching going on there, and a lot of post-weekend analysis needed.
Yeah, and Alonso was really not irritated, but after qualifying, just couldn't get the fronts in. And so if you haven't got the front end grip around Monaco, you're not going to be lapping well. But Ocon was able to get a little bit more out of it. A few little power steering changes for Alonso this weekend that he seemed fairly happy with. He actually said after the race that he thought he was very strong everywhere apart from qualifying, which obviously is Monaco, so that actually does you no good whatsoever. But he was relatively upbeat about things, although it's getting to the point where obviously he needs to turn that upbeatness into a few more results, but I'm sure he will do because he's Fernando Alonso. But one driver that I was pleased to see do what they did was Antonio Giovinazzi. He was a little bit hamstrung because he made Q3, which was a great effort, but then he had to start on the softs, and so he was vulnerable to drivers behind, ended up 10th, which might seem a little bit disappointing given that he could have been a place or two higher. But Mark, we're starting to see Giovinazzi be consistently decent, aren't we? Which is good. Consistently decent sounds damning with faint praise, but he's always annoyed me with how erratic he's been. But he's had five pretty good weekends at worst this season.
Yeah, and we haven't seen any of the silly, scrappy mistakes, and he's been consistently quicker than Kimi in qualifying. And yeah, this was a very, very solid race. Also, the Alpha, it got a new floor, it joined the Z floor club this weekend. And it's definitely more competitive this weekend. I don't know if that's because there was just something about it that's in its DNA that's suited to that track, or whether this will be reflected as we go to other tracks, and it's a result of the upgrade. So it'll be interesting to monitor that and see if they can start nudging into that group ahead of it, because it's so far been in a no man's land. And this weekend it was right in the mix, you know, in among that productive part where you can realistically look at come into a weekend expect to score points.
Do you think that that opportunity for Alpha is partly because of what helped Ferrari as well? Because obviously I think we've seen this weekend that while obviously it's good at low speed, especially the Ferrari is quite clearly a much improved car and a very decent car, and a track where the engine deficit is presumably less emphasized in Monaco. Ferrari is obviously then able to make an even bigger step towards the front. Is it likely to be a similar story with Alfa? Because obviously that car has looked pretty decent in midfield. It has looked better than last year. I think they seem to have been quite happy with the step that they've made. Giovinazzi, as you said, Ed, has been impressive at throughout the start of the season, and probably unlucky not to score points before now. So then coming to a track that's a bit less power sensitive, it can then excel a little bit more in that midfield. Is that oversimplifying it, or is that another factor?
No, I think the fact it was less power sensitive circuit was significant. I asked Xavi Pujolar, the head of trackside engineering, about that, and that was one of the factors that he accepted was part of the story. But also they're making some good steady progress. It's just a really good all-round car. But overall, I was just pleased to see Giovinazzi just get a little bit extra out of it, because sometimes you look at Alpha and you think, oh, it wouldn't have taken much more to get a little bit more out of it. But Giovinazzi's had a lot of bad luck this year, so pleased to see him deliver that. So yeah, I think they're a team that should continue to hover around that sort of Q2 area and be in the mix for the odd point here and there for the rest of the season. Well, Scott, should we have a look at the debutants? Three drivers had their first Monaco Grand Prix weekend. They ended up in the last three positions behind Williams pairing George Russell and Nicholas Latifi, who just drove around where the Williams kind of was. Another good Russell qualifying performance, but the Williams wasn't going to do any more than that in the race. So we had Yuki Tsunoda, crashed on Thursday. Mick Schumacher crashed on Saturday and missed qualifying. Surprisingly, Nikita Mazepin didn't find the wall.
And was at his happiest, the most confident in the car that he's been all season. Which is, I suppose if you're going to wait for any race to find a breakthrough in terms of your ability to hold on to the car, then Monaco is a pretty good place to do that. Mazepin actually was, especially on Thursday, pieced together a really good day, and it was just solid the rest of the time. I guess it was a bit of a baptism of fire, because for all three of them, I said earlier when we were talking about AlphaTauri that Tsunoda just didn't have what Gasly had this weekend. And I remember seeing something from him in the build-up to the race where he sort of said he was banking on experience. You know, he said he'd been to places like Macau, and maybe that would help in terms of adjusting to Monaco. I think you need a little bit more for Monaco than having driven Macau in a Formula 3 car, to be honest. And Tsunoda he's just not on a great run at the moment, is he? So Monaco, not the best place to come when you don't have any experience of it. Mick was a bit ragged. He'd had the wall hit, hadn't he, earlier on in the weekend, and then the big shunt at the end of FP3. But he put a good move on Mazepin on the first lap. It was almost like a sort of, there was like an, you could see it in the background of the World Feeds coverage on the opening lap. It was just like an incidental lunge from Mick into the hairpin on the first lap. But I don't know what happened to him. I lost track of his race. I know that he fell back, later on. I guess the main thing for all three of them is that they, broadly speaking, kept out of trouble during the Grand Prix itself.
Yeah, Mick was ahead of Mazepin and had pulled away. But then towards the end of the first stint, he was having fuel feed problems. So the engine was not pulling coming out of some of the slower corners. It was just stuttering. So he was ordered to let Mazepin pass because it took them a while to sort out that problem. But yeah, solid for Mazepin. He's talked about spending time with the team in between races, and they seem to be understanding each other a little bit more than that they have been. But at the end of the race, he apologised over the radio for not saying a great deal, because he said that something like that was the hardest experience he's ever had in a racing car doing the Monaco Grand Prix. So yeah, his best performance yet. There's still nothing particularly extraordinary, but after his difficult start, at least he's getting somewhere. So let's come back to the front, Mark. Monaco's always a bit of a one-off, isn't it? Do you see this as a particularly significant one in the World Championship battle? Obviously, it's given Red Bull the initiative, and there's been a little bit of the fun stuff off track with people talking about Hamilton talking about Verstappen needing to prove himself, and Verstappen saying, no, I don't need to prove myself, I do my talking on the track. So it's just this championship narrative is just bubbling along nicely in the background, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the best possible result for the championship. And remember, we were saying after Spain that it was looking like a pattern of in the development of between the two cars that Mercedes was pulling ahead. But I questioned that, and I said that coming to Monaco, I was very confident that Red Bull would win. I wasn't thinking that they would have to rely on Ferrari's pole sitting car to fail to do that. But in terms of the ebb and flow between Red Bull and Mercedes, this was definitely a Red Bull sort of track. I have a feeling that we're about to go to a bunch of tracks where the Mercedes will be really strong. So we could, get that narrative changing yet again. But it's close enough. The two cars are close enough that the traits of the track are determining the outcome, and that's great. And the two drivers are, still absolutely, there's going to be very little to choose between them, I think, in terms of points as we get in the run into the late run into the season. I think that's quite a realistic hope. Mm-hmm. And to have a title contest between drivers of two different teams, it's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, the season is continuing to deliver. Five races in. Let's just hope it keeps going, as I keep saying. And the Monaco Grand Prix, yeah, great weekend. And well done to Max Verstappen for getting victory in the illustrious race. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. There's a huge amount of stuff to read there. Mark Hughes's race analysis will be up there by the time this is published, I'd have thought. I, of course, have my driver ratings, where I shall tell you about everybody's weekend and give them a rating out of 10, then you get the chance to disagree with it vehemently in our listener debates. Scott's working on various things. He's having a look at the Valtteri Bottas catastrophe and also looking at the issue of age and experience of the podium finishers, because this was the third youngest podium in F1 history. So we've got some new drivers, young drivers making a big impact, trying to take over the whole show. Do check out our sister podcasts, including the Race IndyCar podcast. Of course, the Indy 500 is coming up, and Bring Back V10s. And if video's your thing, head to our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race. Well, it's been a great Monaco Grand Prix. The season is continuing to give us exactly what we want, which is a great battle between the top two. So join us soon for more from the Race F1 podcast on what we hope is going to be an F1 championship battle for the ages.